Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Bowles and I'm joined by Kate Andrews and Carl Hennigan, Professor of Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford. So we've got used to hearing the government say that we're world-beating in many ways, but there has been a pattern when it comes to coronavirus, and when it comes to league tables, we do stand out, but often for the wrong reason. And this week we had worse news, which adds to that sense, which is that England is the highest level of excess deaths. Kate, can you talk us through the statistics that have made lots of headlines this week and what it says about the UK and the parts of it?
I think it helps, actually, if we go back to mid-May when the government stopped publishing its international comparisons of COVID deaths. It argued at the time that these comparisons weren't like for like, countries were calculating the data differently, and it wasn't helpful, possibly even misleading, to compare at the time. They said there would be a time for doing that. So arguably where the government stopped publishing, the ONS, the Office for National Statistics, has now picked that up. And this week they published a number of all excess deaths across Europe. Now, it's very important to note that's not just COVID-19 deaths. That's all excess deaths above a five-year average. So we could be talking about COVID-19. We certainly are in many respects. But we're also talking about the knock-on effects of COVID-19, lockdown deaths, struggling to access treatment, lower numbers in A&E, and all of that. And the data doesn't bode very well for the UK. England is found to have the highest number of excess deaths in Europe so far. And England, Northern Ireland, Wales, and Scotland are all in the top eight. And this is not the kind of list that you want to come top. Now, the most generous interpretation of this data is something that was revealed a few weeks ago, and Carl has written about this extensively, that Public Health England has actually been calculating COVID deaths in such an extreme way that anybody who got the virus, who then even potentially recovered from the virus and subsequently died of something else, is registered as a COVID death. So arguably our data is the most extreme that you can get when it comes to calculating these COVID figures. But that doesn't explain why the other regions are so high up the list. And I think there are many issues here around care homes, around access to treatment, around how lockdown affected all of our lives that have to be looked into. I'm sure there's more to the data that Carl can go into than meets the eye at first, but there's no way to paint these pictures to say that the UK has done particularly well.
Carl, can you see a positive spin from this? Is it as bad as it sounds on the surface?
Well, look, the first thing is to say the UK is unique with its Office for National Statistics. So the weekly return is precise and a very clear and coherent set of stats, allows people like us to work on it. Many other countries, let's be clear, don't get that richness of data. So the comparisons, number one, will come in time. Right now, it's quite difficult. But what we saw is this rapid upturn in excess deaths in week 13. And at the peak, there was about 11,800 excess deaths than what we'd normally expect, just around about the 10th of April. And then they stayed high for about 7 or 8 weeks thereafter. There are some interesting caveats about excess deaths, though, that are important. The usual way to compare them is with the preceding 5 years, the average of those 5 years. So one thing to remember is, if you've had a very good 5 years, then what happens is when you look at excess, it can look much worse because exactly that has happened. If you look at the data in 2019 and the year preceding that, actually the data was showing under, and particularly in the very elderly. We had a particularly bad year in the winter of 2017 and 18 when people wouldn't recognise that actually there were 50,000 excess deaths in that winter alone. So what we do see is this trend in going up and coming down with the seasonal effect. And I think that's really important to understand that. What's different about the COVID is this rapid increase in a very short period of time and then a return to normal by week 23. And what we've seen over the last 5 weeks is actually now there are fewer deaths than expected compared to the 5-year average over every week for the last 5 weeks. And now there's nearly 1,300 fewer deaths than what we'd expect. So what that suggests is there's been a displacement of some death, with some people who would have died in the summer, had COVID and died early. And that's an important aspect to understand. It's not just how many people died, it's actually how many years of life lost. And so it's interesting and important to recognise that. So with something like flu, you often see many young people affected, particularly young children. When a young child dies, you lose 70, 80 years of life. When somebody old dies, that loss might be much less. That's an important issue to tease out from this data. What's interesting and important about the data, though, as you said, in this last 5 weeks, it's been really important to know that there's been an excess number of deaths in the private home setting from non-COVID causes. And in fact, in the last 5 weeks, there's been more deaths from non-COVID causes in the private home than there actually has been from COVID in any other setting. And that has significant implications. You talked about these excess deaths from non-COVID. Either in the home setting, we're managing expected deaths much better and they're not going to hospital, or many unexpected, avoidable deaths are happening. And that's now a real concern within the data.
So just on that, Carl, ultimately, when people see excess deaths, often I think in the media and elsewhere, they're quite quick to link them to coronavirus. But these could be indirect deaths, things that are exacerbated perhaps by lockdown, by the fact fewer people going in to see doctors. Is that what we're potentially looking at?
So I think there is an interesting aspect. You're allaying to the idea when you have a death certificate, there's something to understand. The first thing is we put down on there the immediate cause of death, and that's part 1A. And then part 1B is what contributed to that immediate cause of death. So you could put COVID, and then you could say what actually contributed to that was conditions like diabetes, hypertension, renal failure. But it could be the other way around. It could be you had a heart attack and then you got COVID. And one of the concerns is that can happen, for instance, if you got the infection while you were in hospital. That's really worrying and concerning. That actually exacerbated a pre-existing condition. So I think this died from COVID versus died with it is an important aspect of the overall impact. But it's important to remember, and I keep making this point, is that if you 75% of the deaths were in people over the age of 75. The age risk here across this disease is huge. So that when you look at children, they are virtually unaffected by this. And there's been very few deaths in children. And in fact, in under 50s, if you've not got another comorbidity, there's so few deaths that actually you wouldn't even notice that COVID was out there if you were looking at that group. Right now, looking at where we are now, there today are 12 deaths reported in hospital. And one of the interesting aspects about thinking about that, that's a very low number. But not all of them people have got active infection in the last week and died. They may have got COVID 3 or 4 months ago. And one of the things we ask the government for and really want to know and understand is what we call the 28-day acute infection to death measure. How many people have got the infection and died within 28 days? Because that's much more of a better measure of this acute infection led directly to your death. And that's why the figures got paused about 10 days ago and we've been pushing for this important measure. One thing is in Scotland, they report that and they're reporting zero deaths much more often than we are. We haven't done that yet, but it's because of this important distinction in the data. Now, the problem is if you've had a test positive from COVID, with the way Public Health England are reporting, irrespective of what you die of, irrespective of when you had that test, you will be counted as a COVID death. And that is unhelpful and it makes a misleading picture.
I've heard in various circles that the government think there could have been around 5,000 coronavirus deaths miscalculated or misattributed to coronavirus as the cause for the very reason Carl just set out. When we're looking at these statistics, it does often feel on social media, also in articles, that people just pick the stat that suits them to make the argument. But is there a wider problem here in the sense that it doesn't feel as though, or it feels at least there is a common problem, whether it's causes of death or if it's looking at, you know, the data behind various lockdowns, the government is not publishing all the data and it means it is quite hard to get a comprehensive picture.
Yes, I think part of the problem is accountability, that if people don't feel like they have the data in front of them, which they can then calculate and dissect and look at it from different perspectives, then they'll never feel like they're being given the full story. Another problem is that a lot of the numbers that are coming out, at least on the surface, reflect what people intuitively feel about the handling of COVID-19 here in the UK. A lot of people think that the UK locked down too late. There's some studies that suggest that isn't necessarily a problem. That's how a lot of people feel. People are very well aware that the management of moving elderly from hospital into care homes was a wreck, that thousands upon thousands of elderly patients were being transferred without so much as a COVID test. So when the government, as it did this week, comes out and praises itself for its handling of COVID-19 alongside this data being published showing the highest excess deaths in Europe happening in England, I think people just feel like something doesn't quite add up. And the last thing I'd say is that I have also heard from government officials in particular that they don't think that these are fair comparisons because the UK is being very honest with its data, it's being explicit with its number of COVID deaths, and they feel other countries aren't. But let's remember, and to this issue that Carl brought up about how actually it looks like we're over-exaggerating COVID deaths here in England, that is the government's fault. That is in the government's ability to control. The government could update its own figures and update its own measures so that we are even more honest. We don't over-exaggerate, but we give a better reflection of the truth. It's hard to listen to those complaints about, oh, well, this is being exaggerated, when that exaggeration actually is something that the government could do something about.
And Carl, isn't it the case that even if we take the Public Health England point on recording deaths, we're not talking about the fact that the UK has a better ability to record and has had a few errors, and therefore we would be closer to Germany. We're much more talking about, we're at the bottom of the league table, so to speak, aren't we?
Yeah, we are at the bottom of the league table. And I think the first point is well made, that the care home was an utter disaster. And one of the reasons when people say to me about, well, lockdown work, and you mentioned that there's some controversy about that, is I say, well, look, if you look at the data on care home outbreaks, all of the outbreaks happened after we went into lockdown. Well, that shouldn't happen. If lockdown worked, the care home should be shielded in that principle and you should be fine. But actually what we ended up with is approaching 44-45% of care homes with outbreaks, which is utterly unacceptable. I mean, nearly 7,000 care homes had outbreaks. And you're right, 25,000 people were discharged in a sort of rush, based on modelling that is shown to be inaccurate, to free up beds in hospital that actually never got filled. Now, that feeding into care homes just does not make clinical sense to me whatsoever. And the difference you said about Germany, for instance, is somewhere like that was testing people twice and they had to have two negative tests before discharge. And that's because they had a better, more comprehensive discharge regime. The second issue which is important to think about Germany is their bed capacity. Their ICC critical care capacity is about threefold ours. I think their hospital beds now is about fourfold ours. And when you think about that, they didn't have the issues of we need 90-gale hospitals, we've got to discharge people. They just don't have that problem. So when you think about this disease and you think, how can we contain it? How can we improve the outcome? Most of it is about actually understanding the infrastructure, understanding how to manage infectious outbreaks. And there are two things that we could do that could make a huge difference. And I'm surprised that these things have not been put at the forefront of the government strategy. One is to have a very clear plan for care homes. And I'll give you a good example. In Hong Kong in 2002-03, they had problems in their care homes in the first SARS outbreak. And they got spooked by it. And because of that, they were prepared this time round. Their care homes had 3 months of PPE in stock. They had training for infection control for staff. They have them on proper wages and structures, so it's aligned with the health system. And they have a clinical team who go into the care home to do things like supportive care. And that clinical team is a specialist team in care homes. If you did that, we would be sat here going, we wouldn't be at the bottom of the league table. The second aspect is our bed capacity is so at the margin of its limits all the time. There is no spare capacity. And much of what happens now is you put people with a highly infectious pathogen into hospitals that are completely unfit for purpose when it comes to unfit infection control. Multi-story flats they are like, with lift shafts where patients are coming up and down, staff are coming up and down. And one of the things is you need spare capacity to have fever hospitals so you can put people aside so you can maintain your normal business so people wouldn't be scared of going to the hospital, and you separate the two completely. And if you don't do that, we're going to end up with this problem again because people are going to be scared to go in hospitals. So our system is not fit for purpose. So if we don't accept that we are at the bottom of the league, if we don't accept there were problems, and I get the caveats, and it is right about the issues of the accuracy of the data, but taking that aside is you've got to look at this and say we've got a lot wrong. And in accepting that, what do we need to fix right now to move forward? So if the next time a pathogen comes like this or it comes back in winter, we will have a system-wide approach in healthcare. That means that we can reduce the morbidity, mortality in those that are the most vulnerable.
And Kate, we've heard on Friday from the government, from the Prime Minister in a press conference, he talked about pausing some lockdown measures, suggested that actually they could start to withdraw some if things keep going in the current direction of travel. Do you get a sense they are learning some of the lessons Carl just talked about? Or are they in a way just trying to repair previous mistakes that perhaps aren't the most effective? I just mean, we're hearing about changes you can make to social care, fever hospitals, things like that. But the government approach, at least from where we're looking at it, seems to be just closing lots of things down, trying to stop any spread rather than working at how you perhaps would deal with the infection when it happens.
The government has clearly learned lessons, but I do worry that they're not the most important ones from a public health perspective. A lot of the talk around the National Health Service and also the government, again, praising itself for its handling of the COVID crisis so far, suggests that perhaps we haven't figured out exactly how our healthcare systems would deal with another pandemic or indeed another wave of this pandemic. Now, a lot of capacity has been built in, not just in terms of beds, also in terms of testing. We know much more about the treatments now. There are plenty of reasons to believe that handling a second wave from the healthcare perspective could go a lot better than the first. But what the government seems to have picked up on most clearly is that it will be criticized if it's ever seen to be moving slowly. It's taking an ultra cautious approach by stopping the easing of lockdown, as you say, Katie, bringing in more local lockdowns, but one must question how local they are. They seem much more regional now that you have 2 in 5 residents in the Northwest under these new kinds of lockdown restrictions. That's not localized as I would define it, and I think a lot of people would define it. I thought the most telling comments today, however, were from Chris Whitty, who was very blunt when he said that he thinks we are reaching the limits of what we can do in terms of opening up, and that the discussion is now moving towards some very difficult trade-offs. If you want to open up parts of society, he implied we might have to shut down other parts of society or we will see a resurge in the virus. There can be a lot of questions as to whether or not the government's inability to properly track and trace means that we have to shut more down or pause more from opening, whether or not the government could have done more to help liberalize us, or whether this is just sadly and begrudgingly the kind of lifestyle we have to live now. But either way, I thought those were very stark words. Boris Johnson still said he's sure people will have a great summer. But 2 arguably different messages coming out of the press conference today, but I thought Whitty's comments really, really struck hard.
And Carl, we'll give you the final word on this podcast. I would ask you if you're going to have a great summer, but I think perhaps the more pressing question is, looking at what the government is saying at the moment in terms of measures they are planning to take to try and prevent a second wave, as Boris Johnson has described it, do you think they're learning the right lessons?
I think we've got a structural problem now. There's a problem with understanding risk, understanding uncertainty, and particularly understanding how to use the evidence to drive interventions and take forward the initiatives. If you understand how pathogens work at this time of year, they circulate at about a rate of about 40 per 100,000 people because we're naturally social distance, we're outside. When we come to winter, they go up about tenfold. to about 400 per 100,000. At that point, we call an epidemic. The people out there don't know this happens. That could be because of flu and so forth. So if we're now considering locking down at these levels, I do concern myself as we go into September and October, we are going to start to get in a mess because we're going to be calling lockdowns everywhere. One of the key about what you should worry about and concern yourself when you go into lockdowns is the impact on COVID disease, not on SARS testing. And by COVID disease, the hospital admissions, the critical care bed occupancies, the deaths. And to be honest with you, they're at such low levels, normally you wouldn't even know that was happening. And I think this is a problem now because all of these strategies that are being employed, masks, infrared thermometers, locking down here, partially doing there, is again saying the test and trace system has failed because the data is not getting quick enough to the front line. But it's also not recognising the wider issues that now exist. And then wider issues are hugely important and concerning. The impact on educational attainment, highly correlated with healthcare and outcomes, what we're doing to our children and where we're putting them in all of this. The economy. The economy is inextricably linked with healthcare outcomes. Never mind somebody's got to pay for all this. You've also got the problem of all these non-COVID deaths that I've talked about. The fact more people are dying in private homes than COVID right now, and it's been completely ignored. And the fact that 50% of people who report a condition is worsening, a non-COVID condition that can be life-threatening, are saying they're delaying their access to healthcare. That's what I'm worried about. At the moment, I'm watching the data. If the data trends up in terms of COVID, not SARS testing, because we're increasing that testing hugely, then it's the time to say, we have an issue, we should deal with it. And I want to remember, everything is important in the media. We've talked about how we deal with that. What really matters is not what you're hearing, is what you're not hearing half the time. And so, for instance, it's gone very, very quiet on Sweden recently. And the fact is, Sweden is bobbing along now at about 30 cases a day. There's no masks. The public's open. Everything is getting on there. Yes, they made the same mistake as we did in care homes, but they're reporting very low deaths, and their society is fully opened up. And they've not taken any of these measures that we're taking so far. And Tegnell was out this week saying, we don't need masks on public transport. We don't need masks in society. There is no evidence to support their use. Why we're getting this wrong is because many of what we're doing is not evidence-based and it is knee-jerk policy and it doesn't know how to understand risk and uncertainty.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for listening.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.